Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Meghna Chakrabarty. With vaccines readily available and 40% of Americans already fully vaccinated, summer could be something that resembles a return to normalcy. And in the fall, that means it'll be back to school for tens of millions of kids across the country. Just this past week, we heard from the three biggest school districts in the country about their back-to-school plans. Here's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
New York City public schools, 1 million kids will be back in their classroom in September, all in person, no remote.
Wow.
And here's Los Angeles School Superintendent Austin Buettner.
Schools will be open in the fall. 5 days, full day, every day.
And yesterday, Chicago Public Schools announced they will also reopen for full-time in-person instruction in the fall. The Department of Education has made it clear it expects schools everywhere to reopen for in-person learning in the fall. But polls show that a sizable number of parents want to stick with remote learning for a variety of reasons. For example, high numbers of parents in working-class Black and brown communities hit hardest by COVID-19 aren't convinced their kids will be safe back at school. So joining us now to talk about all this is U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. And Secretary Cardona, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, it's a really important issue. So tell us what your expectation and hope is for the coming fall in terms of returning to in-person instruction.
You know, I've been listening to those clips that you just showed, and that music's my ears. I expect all students to have an opportunity to be in school every day in the fall. And I expect that the school system that they return to is going to be better than it was prior to the pandemic. So those are some of the expectations that I have. You know, the bar of March 2020 is too low. Our students are coming back with greater need. And I want to make sure that our school system across the country is there to meet their needs.
So give us a sense, Mr. Secretary, if you could, what you understand about right now. What percentage of schools across the country have already returned to in-person learning, and what percentage are offering remote learning and a mix of in-person remote learning? What are we seeing across the country?
Sure. So the data systems used to collect these that we have are being developed. You know, we have some March data. I think next week we're going to get updated data. So the data that I'm going to share with you right now is a month and a half old. But we know that about 90% of our students are being offered in-person learning opportunities. Over half are full-time in-person. Again, that was late March. So I know that the numbers are much better now. But as you said earlier, it's uneven. There are some groups of students who are coming in at a less percentage. And that's part of the work that we're going to have as educators to make sure that all students are accessing in-person learning and that some of those fears are addressed.
That's right. And let's talk about those fears, because, of course, we do know that there are families, particularly families in low income and communities of color, Black and brown communities that were hit very hard by COVID-19, that have concerns about sending their kids back into the classroom for understandable reasons. Right. So how do we address those fears?
You know, I remember a year ago, this time of year, looking at the data, I was commissioner in Connecticut, looking at the data and seeing that in more densely populated communities or in communities where there were more people of color, communities of color, there was a greater mortality rate. The transmission rate was higher. So it's understandable that there's fear. It's understandable that there's some hesitation still, keeping in mind that many of these communities lost loved ones more than other communities, that they're dealing with the trauma of the pandemic in different ways. So I think we have to recognize that. And to address that, some of the strategies, as you asked, you know, I was in Boston recently and I saw that they put vaccination clinics in the communities, in those same communities, and members of the community with social capital, people that were trusted in the community, the pastors, the teachers, the school leaders, were the ones communicating with families about the efficacy of vaccines, of the safety of it. We're modeling how they're getting it and that they're getting it for their families so that there's a sense of trust that you know, they're going to be okay and that the vaccines are going to help provide that level of safety that we need in our schools and in our communities. So having messaging done by the people that in these communities that are trusted and well-known in those communities matters, and ensuring that we're going to them, that if we're doing vaccine clinics, we're doing it in places that they're familiar with. It could be their schools, it could be their churches, it could be community centers. That's what I saw in Boston. They were doing vaccines in community centers. So those are some ways to increase the confidence.
Right. I mean, obviously getting more people vaccinated is crucial. But one of the issues we have is a lot of kids who are going to be going back to school are going to be under 12 years old. And we're not certain at this point when they're going to be able to be vaccinated. So how do you address the quite understandable fears of parents sending their younger kids, right, kids under 12, back into schools? It seems like that's an important bit of messaging that you need to figure out.
Sure, it is. It is. So we do know that vaccines are a tremendous tool, but it's not the only tool.
Right.
We've seen success across the country of schools opening without transmission in their schools since August of this past year. So I can tell you my children have been able to attend school since August of last year, and they were able to do it in a way that was safe. I would not compromise the safety of my children either. So we can show examples of it. We can communicate with families. We can continue to share that messaging that the mitigation strategies work. And now that the transmission rates are where they are, we can continue to build confidence and slowly get them in. I would argue that we need to take advantage of the summer months to get these families comfortable, sending their children to school, giving them opportunities to be with other students. We know there's no substitute for in-person learning. Mm. We know there's no substitute for that social interaction that our little ones need. So I think, you know, we have to continue to communicate and make sure that when we're communicating, we're also allowing those folks who have good relationships in the community with these families to be a part of that messaging.
Do you think, though, that going forward, at least into the fall and a little bit beyond, that remote learning will still have a place? In other words, so I'm looking at some national polling on this that found that around 58% say they want to have the option of both in-person and remote learning. Given that there's still such a strong feeling that there's a place for remote learning, do you regard that as a priority as well, that there should be that option?
You know, I think instead of calling it remote learning, I'll call it blended learning, right?
Yeah.
So some mix of in-person and remote learning is blended learning. And for years before the pandemic, many districts were working hard to try to give opportunities to students to learn remotely, because not all learning happens in the classroom. Hmm. And we have to take advantage of the fact that learning can take place elsewhere. So I think this is going to accelerate that opportunity under innovative ideas, right? So I'd love to see innovation. I said earlier, we don't want to go back to a school system that like what it was before the pandemic. We want to do better. And we learned that blended learning does provide opportunities for students that they wouldn't have if they had to report to a brick and mortar building every day. We know that you might have access to courses now because you can learn them online that you didn't have access to before, because maybe staffing needs or limited enrollment in certain classes. So there's tremendous opportunity for remote learning to be a part of the landscape in education moving forward. I think it has to be done creatively and ensuring that we're giving students more opportunities.
I'm wondering if you think in terms of that blend of in-person or remote learning, if you're thinking about which subjects lend themselves more to which form of learning. I mean, obviously, I mean, to pick two obvious examples, band practice, sports is sort of requires, I mean, works much better, obviously, if you're in person. But what about the academic subjects? Are there subjects that work better, in your view, than others for families to think about in terms of remote learning versus in-classroom learning?
I would definitely think so. You know, it's and keep in mind, again, there is no substitute for in-person learning, but you can enhance learning or you can take courses that may not be offered in your building. Think about, Anthony, think about the benefits for students who are enrolled in schools. And this includes our rural students. Think about the benefit for students who are enrolled in schools that have very limited advanced placement offerings or early college experience credit because of staffing. Now these students have access to online learning where maybe a teacher in a different part of that community could be teaching it to students that are in multiple schools. I look at that as a benefit. I do think that some courses lend themselves more than others. You're not going to be learning on how to take apart an engine or how to build a robot totally through the computer, but it might be that part of the course is that. It could also be, Anthony, I could envision a student taking a course, sitting at a advanced manufacturing site, learning the theory through Zoom, and then getting out into the shop field, into the shop, and doing hands-on learning in an actual advanced manufacturing plant or a robotics plant. So there's tremendous potential.
So, listeners, we are talking about a return to in-person learning in the fall. And throughout this hour, we're also going to be hearing from some parents about why they're feeling hesitant about that. And I'm talking with Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. And, Mr. Secretary, I know I have to let you go in about a minute and a half. I want to ask you about another subject, about the Biden administration's push to promote critical race theory in schools and some of the pushback you're getting from some states. As you know, a coalition of 20 attorneys general wrote to you recently with concerns about this. And the letter, which contends that critical race theory teaches that schools should analyze and interpret American history and government primarily through the narrow prism of race. And they're concerned that the Department of Education is making this a priority in some of its grant programs. What's your response to these folks? What are you telling them?
We firmly believe at the agency that it's critically important as we think about reopening and reimagining school that we correct some of the things that we maybe didn't do well. And for me, it's really about making sure students have curriculum that where they can see themselves in it. But it doesn't mean that we have a role in curriculum. I don't think federal government has a role in it at all. It's a state thing. And I think it's becoming politicized, to be very honest with you. I know our educators know what they're doing, and I have confidence in our educators to make sure that all students feel seen in their curriculum, and then we can come together as
Secretary Miguel Cardona, United States Secretary of Education, thanks so much for joining us. A lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today we're talking about the return to in-person learning in the fall and why some parents are more than ready to send their kids back to the classroom and why some are hesitant. Sharnissa Secret is a clinical social worker and a mother of six in Portland, Oregon. She's Black, and she told us that in-person learning was difficult for her eighth grade son, Josh.
He experienced a lot of bias towards him. And I would say it's been a conversation, ongoing conversation I've had with, unfortunately, a lot of his teachers since kindergarten. And honestly, a lot after those conversations with the teachers, they were very responsive, but it was a very tiring to have to bring that awareness about racism and bias and how to treat my child.
Sharnissa says all those conversations were the result of problems Josh was having at school around discipline. She says a couple of years ago, he was coming home with so many discipline referrals that it was affecting his ability to learn.
It was just ridiculous. Like, he would scribble on his hand and he'd be called out for damaging school property. He would be jittery in class, right? My kid also sees in the class that the white child may be doing some of the similar things or even worse. And they're being, redirected, And these kids see it, The kids who are marginalized, they will see when other students are being treated more fairly.
But since the pandemic hit, Josh, like millions of kids, has been learning remotely. And Sharnissa says that works a lot better for him. She says he's happier because, among other things, all those discipline referrals from school have stopped.
Now that he's home, the only referrals he's getting is from me and his dad. So, and he's cool. He can get those referrals with his boxer shorts on, like, okay, yeah, whatever. But it's just less pressure, right? It's like, again, more focusing on his academic. And then it brings us back to that focus, like, what are you doing, right? And then we can really see if he's having attention issues, what areas he needs to really work on, right? I think that was the issue a lot for him, is that he didn't get it, but now he's saying he understands more, like he's comprehending more.
Sharnissa isn't sure if Josh will return to full-time in-person learning in the fall, but she says if and when he does, she hopes it will be more inclusive for him.
You're not going to be able to provide the same environment. So just, do what you can, but, make sure that he feels safe and seen.
That's Sharnissa Secret, a clinical social worker and a mom of six in Portland, Oregon. And joining us now is Janelle Scott. She's the Robert C. and Mary Catherine Bergino Distinguished Chair in Educational Disparities and professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Scott, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you for inviting me, Anthony.
I'd love to just start the conversation with a little bit of what we've heard so far in the program. Let me get your response to what you heard from Secretary Miguel Cardona about his commitment to the idea that we've got to get all schools ready for in-person learning in the fall. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's certainly it's heading in the direction that I think most people want to head to, which is getting children and adolescents back into school full time. And I think we still have much to reckon with as a result of the pandemic, which is still ongoing. As you pointed out, there's still not vaccines available to children under 12. And so, this does raise concerns for parents and teachers and anyone who works in school buildings about, the rise of variants and the possibility of community spread. And so, as in every point of this pandemic, we have to really be multifocal and think about not only educational needs of students, but also the health needs of communities. And so as we move to fully in-person in the fall, as the secretary and other school district leaders are indicating is desirable, we can't lose focus on this ongoing health crisis.
Right, which is obvious, which, as you suggest, is far from completely resolved. I mentioned some of the data and the polling about what parents want. And in general, the numbers seem to be suggesting that folks want both in-person and mm-hmm. remote. And it seems mm-hmm. to be telling us that in general, low-income and brown and black communities, parents, especially in those communities, want the option of remote learning. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that and what else stands out to you about these numbers and what you're sort of understanding about what people want across the country.
So I think these polls are informative in many ways, and in other ways they leave us with some ambiguity. People are really operating in an information vacuum, right? So even as a parent myself, when I fill out those surveys for my own district, I'm sort of being hypothetical because mm-hmm. I don't know what protections are going to be provided in the schools. Like, will there is the HVAC system upgraded? Will there be air filtration? Those are the kinds of data points that you can't communicate on surveys. And so I think where we see parents saying they want the option for both is they want to make sure that if it doesn't feel right, if it's not safe, if it's not good for their children, that there's an option, there's a fallback, because, you know, we were all knocked on our heels in the spring of 2020, where we all had to scramble, right, when everything shut down. And so I think there's a kind of desire for people to have something to fall back on. And then, you know, parents in minoritized communities who often go to school, have their children going to school in segregated settings, you know, have a well-earned sense of mistrust about whether their schools will be prioritized along these safety metrics. And not only, you know, the sort of health safety, but also, as Ms. Secret was just communicating about her own child, where their children be safe and loved and cared for and honored and not overly disciplined and policed in schools when they head back in the fall.
I wanted to ask, I'm glad you brought up Sharnisa Secret, because I wanted to ask you about what we heard and sort of what she experienced, and really came to the conclusion that she prefers remote learning for her son, Josh, for the reasons that you just outlined. And we heard Secretary Cardona talking about, you know, returning to schools and making them even better than before the pandemic. And I think some of the issues that he was referring to there are, you know, the kinds of inequities that have been revealed by this pandemic. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. What sort of inequities have been revealed? And are you confident that we might be facing an opportunity to actually address them in a way that is more real and more concrete as we move into this next phase?
I do hope so. I think not only has COVID revealed these inequities, but a global reckoning with racial injustice. Yeah. That began with the murder of George Floyd, where we've been having quite frank conversations about, you know, the deep racial divides across all sectors of our society. And so certainly education is one of those spaces where there has been a lot of conversation and a lot of hard thinking. And I think that there are many districts and many communities that are embracing the opportunity to take very sober and clear looks at themselves and their practices around school discipline, around tracking of children in terms of who gets access to high-level curriculum and who doesn't, around questions of disability and serving all children, regardless of their neurotypical or neuroatypical or social and emotional profile. And so I think that these are conversations that I hope will continue in the years to come. I think they're promising and productive, and we certainly have a lot of good ideas about how to meet all children and serve all children equitably.
I want to ask you, too, to the extent that you might have concerns about a system that has historically underserved certain populations. And now these populations might have the opportunity to choose remote learning rather than sending their kids back to school, if they're lucky, if they have that choice. And I'm just wondering, what would be the consequences of that? Because it seems like the polling suggests that more communities of color, more Black and brown communities, favor the idea of keeping their kids in remote learning settings more than more affluent communities would. And I'm just wondering, to what extent does that raise the concern of sort of parallel and potentially unequal education avenues?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think it's at all clear to me that what people have indicated on these polls is what they're going to actually do in the fall. Because, again, people have been operating in this incredibly kind of unsettled terrain where you have, you know, some children going remotely, some children going in person, some children going in hybrid fashion. And so we haven't really given parents an opportunity at scale across the country. There are some parts of the country that have been open, as Secretary Cardona said, for some time with his own children. So it's not at all clear that even parents who have indicated that they would prefer remote offerings will actually do that come fall. We'll have to see. But I do think that there are some equity issues in terms of the quality, right, of remote learning. And we do know that online platforms in general tend to be relatively untested in terms of peer review around the quality of instruction and the quality of learning. And there are some exceptions to that always, of course, but to the extent that minoritized populations might opt for remote learning, then it really there's an imperative there to drastically improve the quality of that. Those are usually provided through, third-party operators and not the public school systems themselves.
I'm curious as well to get a sense from you about how you assess the long-term effects of so much remote learning over the past year plus. What are your biggest concerns and you know, the flip side of that, what have we learned that's positive about what remote learning has offered us in a positive sense?
Well, so I think in terms of some of the challenges first, I think what hasn't been discussed yet is just the fact that, the estimates are that over 40,000 children in the United States have lost a parent to COVID. So just think about, the sort of scale of that loss. And that doesn't include children whose family members have become ill and maybe long-term disabled. And so children are dealing, and adolescents are dealing with an incredible amount of loss and trauma just from the pandemic. Mm. And I think we need to hold that constant because our children need us. They need us to show up for them. They need us to help them process what they have been through in the last year. That's a lot, right, for an adult to hold. But children have been experiencing this together, this just unprecedented national loss of life. Schools, on the positive side, when they work well, are a place that students are able to make sense of their worlds in community, right? And so what I'm optimistic about that schools can provide, especially with the infusion of federal money, is really just this connection to community. There are lots of community organizations that work to support students and schools and teachers and school leaders who have also been through a very, very difficult year. We have ideas about how to deliver rigorous, culturally relevant curricula that can really meet students, all students, where they are and help them to learn how to learn and live and play together in a multiracial and democratic society. And so really, our public schools are just this ideal space for us to rebuild better, not only in terms of education, but in terms of our society more broadly.
We're talking about the return to school, how many parents are looking forward to that, and how some parents are hesitant to send their children back for a variety of reasons, including the fact that vaccines won't be available for kids under 12 years old, at least not until, well, we're not sure when, but certainly not by September. So we're asking you to join the conversation as well. You can reach out to us on social media at Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio if you want to make a comment or ask a question. Anna Hunter writes on Facebook, in the state of Iowa and Texas, mask mandates have become illegal. We need federal protection to ensure we have the choice of a classroom where parents and kids have agreed to wear masks until a vaccine is available. Janelle, does that sound like a reasonable concern on Anna Hunter's part?
I think it's certainly a reasonable concern. And I think it's a concern that I hear from a lot of parents, frankly, particularly because of the lack of a widespread vaccine for very young children. But this is where politics and ideology meet public health, right? And so if we really are committed, if state and district leaders are really committed to bringing children back to school, then it should be with these sort of very minimal protections that masks are required.
Mm. Janelle, you're a parent yourself, and I'm wondering how you're feeling about all this and dealing with it, if I can ask you personally, sort of how you're making this calculation.
Sure. I feel very fortunate in that my children are over 12, and so they've had their first dose of the vaccine. Just feeling very, very grateful for that and incredibly, honestly relieved after that those needles went into those arms. It makes me feel a lot better because they were both going to school on a hybrid fashion. And I sent them because they even though they liked going to school often in their pajamas, they were really, really missing friends and missing their school community. And so they really wanted to go back, even though my husband and I were a little nervous. We sort of squashed our own nerves and let them go back on a hybrid basis. And, you know, on those couple days a week, they were happier than they've been in over a year.
Really? And that was absolutely noticeable. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely noticeable. Yeah.
And can I ask, if they were under 12 or if one of them was under 12 and not vaccinated, how would you be feeling about it?
I think much more nervous, for sure. I, you know, I think the school is doing a really good job in, you know, being safe, bringing back children in groups. So in a smaller set of children and with some spacing. But what I would like to see for all of our children is more robust testing and tracing in school districts. There are these claims that, you know, schools have not been sites of community spread or even spread within the school, but we actually don't really know because we don't have dashboards that are providing that information. And so a lot of that information tends to pass through word of mouth within school communities. So I would like to see a much more robust and at-scale system of testing and tracing in schools as we head back in the fall. I think that would make a lot of parents much more comfortable.
Janelle Scott, we're coming up on a break, so only about 20 seconds here. But I want to ask you quickly the same question that I asked Secretary Cardona. Do we know, do you have thoughts about sort of what particular subjects lend themselves best to remote learning and which ones don't?
I think that's a hard question to answer because it's both subject matter and it's the nature of the child. So
sure.
I think the power of these remote offerings is that we can tailor it to the individual needs of children, but to think about it as supplementary and not supplanting.
Right, right. We're talking about Janelle Scott. Please stand by. We're going to be coming right back. We're talking about the return to school and parents' hesitancy to send their children back. Tell us what you think. Send us a message on Facebook or on Twitter at On Point Radio. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow on the show, we are reassessing work culture after living through a pandemic for over a year. Are you feeling burned out at work? Are you rethinking work-life balance? Are you thinking about a new career? We want to hear your stories, especially if you found solutions in your workplace. Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. Tell us your story. We'll put you on the show tomorrow. Today, we're talking about the return to school and the reason some parents are feeling hesitant about that decision. Heather Rell is a stay-at-home mom of 11-year-old Mila and 9-year-old Felix. Since the pandemic began, they've been learning from home.
I'll be honest, last March, when we went into what I'm going to call crisis schooling, it was terrible, but we all got by and did what we needed to do to finish out the school year. Our district really took the time to educate teachers and train them as much as they could before rolling into this next school year. They actually pushed the start date back to the school so that they could get some extra training for our teachers. And the teachers have been great this year. They've been really good, really engaging to the kids.
Rel says she'd prefer to send her kids back to in-person learning. And in Austin, she can do that because schools have been open for in-person learning since October. But Rel has opted to keep her children home and continue with remote learning. And the reason why, she feels it's safer.
For our elementary school, we have, you know, last year we had 850 students enrolled. Yeah, in our elementary school, right now they have opened the doors back to everybody that wants to come back in person. I mean, but I heard somebody say the school is full and they're only at 50% capacity-ish. So I just can't imagine all 800 students being back into the classroom and it being socially distanced and all of that, especially since none of these kids will be vaccinated next year.
COVID vaccines are approved for children 12 and older, as we've mentioned, but younger kids will have to wait. Rel says she's considering sending her 11-year-old daughter back to school next year, but she gave up on that idea after Governor Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, banned schools from requiring masks. And for her son, Felix, she has another concern.
He was born with a congenital heart defect called truncus arteriosus. He's at moderate risk of getting something more severe than a normal kid.
So until the vaccines are approved for kids under 12, Rel wants to keep her kids in remote learning next year. But in Texas, that's complicated.
Back in January, when they were asking us to register for the next year, our school district said, yes, we do plan on offering online schooling next year. And it wasn't until recently when they weren't going to be able to get the funding for online school that they've started to walk that back.
Texas lawmakers, in fact, are currently considering measures that would fund remote learning, something that dozens of school districts in the state are supporting. If that funding doesn't come through, and if remote learning isn't an option, Rel says she'll consider homeschooling her kids until she's confident they can be protected.
All I can say is I'm not a teacher. I'm not great at that. But, my kids' health and safety comes first.
So today we're talking about the return to school and the reason some parents are feeling hesitant. We're joined by Janelle Scott. She's a professor at University of California, Berkeley, who focuses on the relationship between education policy and equality of opportunity. And joining us now as well is Mike Waldrop. He's the superintendent of Frisco Independent School District in Texas. And Superintendent Waldrop, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I know you've been listening along. I'd like to hear what is in the cards for your school district in Frisco, Texas, come the fall.
Well, we plan on offering a virtual learning option to all our students. Of course, that is still contingent on the state legislature passing a bill. We got some favorable information yesterday. There was a House bill that went over to the Senate that would allow for us to teach, to offer virtual learning. It did pass out of the Senate with some amendments, and I think it's in a conference committee. So we're hopeful that that will continue on to the governor's desk, and he'll sign that so that we can have that option for our students in the fall.
I see. So this would be a sort of hybrid situation if this funding bill passes, where you could encourage as many kids who want to come back to school, but they could also work remotely from home.
Yeah, that's correct. It would just be another option for our families for a number of reasons. We've been working on trying to make a more robust virtual option for our students under current law for a number of years, and this has just accelerated that. And we currently have about 1,000 of our students that have asked to have a virtual learning option in the fall.
And what do you think about that looking forward? I mean, is remote learning going to be a permanent fixture in the future of education, do you think, in Frisco, Texas? Would you like it to be? Is that important?
Well, I think it will be, and I'm basing that on the fact that we have, over the past few years, had more and more students ask for virtual options. You know, for example, we have some elite Olympic hopeful type athletes whose schedules don't fit very well into a typical school day. And they've asked us for remote learning options. And we have not been able to accommodate that simply because the law in Texas wouldn't allow it, because we couldn't receive enough funding to have a robust virtual option for those kids. And we also have students that fall ill from time to time, and they need some significant inpatient treatment, sometimes even out of state. And a lot of times what those students have to do is they withdraw from our school district. They go for the period of time, which is usually weeks at a time, to receive the treatments, and then they will come back to us and re-enroll, and we spend a great deal of time trying to catch them back up. So it would be really nice if we could offer those options to those students, and there could be a continuity and continuation of their education. And then we've also found out during COVID that some of our students and parents have reported to us that they've actually done better in a virtual environment. So we would like to have that be an option for our families in Frisco ISD.
Mm. Janelle Scott, I want to ask you about the idea that remote learning could become, a permanent fixture in the future of the education system. And Mike Waldrop thinks that would be a good idea. What's your view?
So I think, like Superintendent Waldrop, I agree that there are specific situations for which remote learning might be ideal. So children who are ill, children who have these special circumstances. But I think we have to think, we also have to think holistically. And one of the concerns about remote learning is the platform on which it happens. And so many of those platforms are offered through for-profit providers, so these contracted out. And what I would like to see is these remote offerings really that districts are able to build the capacity to offer them in-house, because many of these platforms, they vary in terms of their how the platforms are informed by robust understandings of how children and adolescents learn. And so we have some quality control issues that I think we need to be smart about as we go forward, if we expand this and make this more permanent. And then the other concern that has been raised by a lot of watchdog groups and researchers is data privacy through these platforms. And very often parents are deeply uninformed about the kinds of privacy protections they're signing away when their children participate on these remote platforms. And so that, for those reasons, I'd like to see districts exert a bit more control and oversight as we move forward.
Interesting. Superintendent Waldrop, respond to Professor Scott's those two concerns about the concerns about data privacy and the sort of integrity, if you will, of the platforms on which online learning is offered.
Sure. What we originally did in the fall was supply our students with a district device, which has some security features on it. We also monitor that quite closely. When you have a student in a remote learning setting, the parents also in that setting have to be, I think, a little bit more watchful of what's going on with their student in that remote environment. But I don't think it's anything that can't be overcome. And remote learning or virtual learning is certainly not something for every student. And currently in the law that's being proposed in the state of Texas, we will have the option to bring students back into an in-person environment if they're not doing well in a virtual setting. And I think this will continue to evolve over time, and we'll see things that we need probably to put in place to better monitor some things, but I don't think it's anything that can't be overcome.
Interesting. Janelle Scott, I'd like to ask you about that idea that if a student is not doing well, they could be brought back in from an sort of an online teaching universe, if you will, back into the classroom. Is that an important kind of backstop to ensure that all kids are essentially being educated the way they should be?
I think it is important, as I said, to have some sort of oversight, some sort of regulation and monitoring about how these things are working. Where I think it gets a little trickier is, what does it mean to do well? mm-hmm. right, in a remote platform? Is it showing up? How do we measure learning? How do we measure progress? How do we ensure that children's social and emotional health is sound? And so I think we need to get very clear on what it means to do well and what would be a trigger for someone to need to come back to in-person learning. And I think, you know, these are questions that, you know, we're learning on the fly as we are in this unprecedented situation. But these are questions that I don't think anyone has sort of comprehensive answers to.
Mm. Superintendent Waldrop, what do you think the biggest lesson that you learned over the last year plus that came from remote learning? What have you taken away?
Well, I think our biggest lessons were you can't simply take the methods and ways of delivering instruction in an in-person setting and just suddenly take that and use it in a virtual environment. It's a different way to engage kids. And to the points that are being made, you know, you have to continually assess learning in a virtual environment just like you do in an in-person environment. And I know most people are aware we have a very robust assessment and accountability system in Texas. And again, one of the things in this bill that's being proposed is that virtual students for the courses and grade levels where they are assessed by the state will have to come in an in-person setting and take those assessments. So I think with our own internal assessment strategies and the formative and summative assessments that we'll use throughout the year, we'll be able to monitor student progress and keep a pretty good handle on how our students are doing.
I'm curious if this law passes in Texas and you get this funding, should it include new training for teachers? Because I'm just thinking about what I observed with one of my own kids when his learning went remote last March. I admired what the teachers tried to do with no notice, but it was clear that they were trying to figure this out on the fly. And I'm just wondering to what extent teachers are going to require real training, real sort of systematic thinking about how best to present stuff online.
Well, I think they will require training, and we did, you know, we had our urgent sort of emergency situation in March and April and May last year, but then last summer, we spent a great deal of time coming back and retraining teachers and rewriting our curriculum to fit the virtual environment. And then there are several things in this bill that's being proposed is that teachers do have to receive training and professional development in how to deliver instruction in a virtual environment. And there's also been some amendments, I think, added to this bill that will require some of our state universities to include training new teachers in how to teach in a virtual environment. So I think those things are concerns for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think we're putting some things in place to help deal with that issue.
And Professor Scott, is that happening to the extent that you can understand in a broad way across the country? I mean, for folks that are sort of continuing to embrace the idea that remote learning is going to be with us for a while, are teachers getting the training they need to do that?
I think it varies by district. We're in a decentralized public education system in this country, and
right.
So it certainly varies by district. I think, I'm also a teacher in a university setting, and so I've also had to relearn and open myself up to new ways of thinking about instruction remotely, and so I think what we know about teachers is that they are learners as well and always interested in building their craft and adding to their pedagogical toolkits. And so, but I also just want to acknowledge for the teachers who might be listening out there that we all know how tired you are. We all know how hard you've been working, teachers and school leaders and district leaders. And so I know for many of them, when they hear the prospect of more professional development and training after these last 14 months, they probably just want to lie down. So I think of this as, planning, planning for the long term. Certainly, this should be built into how we think about ongoing professional development and teacher learning.
Well, clearly this pandemic has shown us the way forward in so many different ways around so many different areas, and education chief among them. Janelle Scott, professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Her research focuses on the relationship between education, policy, equality of opportunity. Professor Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. It was great having you. I appreciated your insights.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And Mike Waldrop is the superintendent of the Frisco Independent School District in Frisco, Texas. Superintendent Waldrop, it was great having you on the program as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.